Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and the Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist program that Angela Walker and I ran on. So I don't have a long introduction today. I just want to focus on one thing, and that is this demand for ceasefire now, which is being raised all over the world. It seems to be working in this country. We've now got 13 senators calling for a cessation of hostilities. Biden administration is at least asking for humanitarian pauses to let the aid get into Gaza. We got, I don't know how many, but probably about a dozen or more on the House side as well calling for a ceasefire. And there's legislation that Rashida Tlaib introduced. So, you know, our demands, our demonstrations, our letters are starting to work. And, you know, time is of the essence. We got to get this as soon as possible. The horrific war crimes continue. I mean, yesterday, or maybe it was the day before, the ambulance caravan convoy outside the Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest hospital in Gaza City, was bombed. They tell people to, the Israelis tell people to move south, and they move to the south, and they go to refugee camps there, and then they get bombed there. It's horrific. With numbers, official numbers from the Ministry of Health or whatever it's called in Gaza, has nearly 10,000 deaths and over 30,000 wounded. We're talking about tens of thousands now, and it's accelerating. So we got to get this ceasefire. And you know what I've been advocating, and we'll put in the chat again the article I wrote about Palestine, Ukraine, and international socialist solidarity. You know, maybe I could have stated it more clearly in that article, but what I think we really got to be pushing for is a ceasefire and then a real peace process to replace the war. You know, Israel wants to get Hamas. Well, and I've talked about this, if we had real elections in the Palestinian territories using proportional representation, we know from many polls that that would marginalize Hamas politically. And then the international law embodied in the UN General Assembly Resolution 242 would open up the peace process. It calls for a two-state solution on the 1967 borders, but the main point is to get the negotiations going. And the point of elections is so that the Palestinians have a unified government or authority that is legitimate in the eyes of the Palestinians and also internationally. And to pressure for that, the U.S. has got to not just push for a ceasefire, but tell Israel they don't get aid unconditionally anymore, military aid especially, unless they are prepared to negotiate in good faith, stop the settlements, end the apartheid laws. The U.S. cannot just give Israel whatever it asks for without any conditions. That is what has brought us to this crisis. So ceasefire now. We got to keep pushing for that. There are demonstrations going on right now. There's one in D.C. at Freedom Square. I just looked in on the video. It looks like they filled Freedom Square. I don't know how many people that is. I would say certainly several thousand. And how much, I couldn't tell from the video, how much is spilling out from there. They're going to march to the White House and do a vigil later. There'll be a big march in San Francisco, which somebody said would have 15 to 20,000. You know, this is a good start. It's not on a scale we really need, but it's being taken notice. I saw cable TV was covering the March on Washington. So if you're here, you're not there, but I hope you have a good reason. I'm here because I have to do this at 3, or I'd be down in D.C. today too. So that's the main thing I wanted to talk about. I also wanted to note that, you know, the climate crisis has kind of taken a back seat, but we're getting terrible news. Every time a new study comes out, the news is worse, whether it's the heating of the ocean, the killing of coral reefs, the threat to the one of these big ice shelves in Antarctica, which would really raise sea levels if it rises. And, you know, it looks like it may calve off of the main island there and start, or main continent, Antarctica, and start melting. The melting in Greenland is accelerating. So it also in the, you know, northern, far northern reaches where you have tundra starting to melt, releasing not just carbon dioxide, but methane, which is much more potent in the short term. We're really in a serious situation. James Hansen, the foremost, most famous climate scientist in this country, and his colleagues just came out with a study saying they see the heat accelerating, the rise in global temperatures accelerating. They attribute that to the reduction in particulate pollution, which is an ironic result as we switch from fossil fuels to renewables. Less particulate matter is released, but that reflects sunlight out, so it's actually accelerating heating in the short term. That's been challenged by other scientists like Michael Mann, who's well known as well. But the overall picture is we're really headed over the cliff. And meanwhile, the Biden administration keeps approving these new fossil fuel projects. Now, the latest one is a big natural gas, liquefied natural gas export facility on the coast down there in Louisiana. So, you know, both of these issues and many others just say, you know, to us, we got to really step up our game in the Green Party because we need an alternative. You know, the Democrats are, you know, back in Israel to the hilt when it commits these war crimes. And it's not responding to the climate crisis. And then we have all the other problems from housing to healthcare that are just not being addressed. So that's why we need a Green Party. So let's talk about whatever issues you want to talk about. Scout Trooper, I don't know if anyone asked you this before, but thoughts on Cornell and RFK going independent. I'm not sure what to feel. Well, Robert Kennedy Jr. is a conspiracy nut. He's taking as many votes from Trump or even more, according to the polls, than he is from Biden. I think he's coasting on his name with the Democrats who think they want to vote for him, and with his, you know, anti-vaccine stuff with the Republicans. He's a wild card. He's up at 17-19%, depending on the poll. But if history is any indication, that's going to come way down. I think particularly if he does get ballot lines, and I think he has the capacity to raise the money to do that, he's really going to be attacked in the mainstream media. I think Cornel West, his campaign is the walking dead, because I don't think he can raise the money to get on ballots. He needs over 200,000 good signatures in California, 150,000 in Texas, 113,000 in Florida. Those are all states the Green Party has ballot access. I don't think he can raise the money to hire the petitioners to do that, or he doesn't have a volunteer base that could do that. So I think Cornel West is on his way out. I noticed in the Axios article a couple of weeks ago, pretty detailed on Cornel West's campaign, the author interviewed Cornel West and Peter Dow, his campaign manager at the time, and they were saying, you know, it'll be easier to get on a ballot as an independent. They don't know what they're talking about. They just more than double the number of signatures that they need to get in the amount of money he raised over the summer came to about $300,000, of which $200,000 has been spent. He just doesn't have the resources or the campaign organization. I mean, I don't know what his fundraising operation is, but it's not like he's been asking for money. I haven't been getting regular mail, emails. It's pretty pathetic. When I wrote the article for Capitol Hill Citizen, soon after he announced at the request of, you know, Ralph Nader and Russell Mokhiber, you know, I had some questions, the first of which was, you know, after joining or saying he would run as a People's Party candidate after just talking to his wife and his brother without knowing all the, you know, baggage the People's Party had in their ballot lines. I mean, it was, he didn't have a campaign plan. He didn't have a campaign team. And he's running for president. I mean, it just showed he didn't really know what he was doing. Moving to the Green Party was a good move, and then he moved away, which was a bad move, and just in terms of getting on the ballot. So I think he's, at the end of that Axios article, they interviewed Ralph Nader, who said, well, there are pros and cons of running as the Green Party candidate or as an independent. But the last sentence of the article was, the good thing about running as an independent is it's easier to drop out, which I think was not just an observation. I think it was probably a prediction. So I don't think Cornel West is going to be a factor. Kennedy's a wild card, but he's not advocating the kind of things we want to advocate. You know, his 100% support for whatever Israel does is problematic. His insensitivity to what the Russians are doing to the Ukrainians is problematic. I mean, his international politics are just terrible, not to mention his crazy conspiracy theories about all kinds of things. So those are my thoughts. Kerry Campbell, Cornel West has no campaign manager, no ballot access coordinator, no experience, having lost both since leaving the Green Party. Yep, that's, I think, pretty much the picture. And I think once the media realizes he's not going to be on the ballot, they're going to stop paying him any attention. And he's going to realize that he's just, you know, talking, you know, and nobody's hearing him. Steve Welser, this would be a good year for Greens to run a strong candidate for president, because the multiple alternative challengers, Kennedy, West, et cetera, might minimize the Greens' spoiler demonization. Yeah, I think that's true. I think the stronger argument is Biden is destroying his base. We've got polling showing that many, particularly more progressive and younger Democrats, are not going to vote for Biden because of his position on Israel. They're alienated, and I don't know how Biden's going to get them back. Trump is losing support as well among the general public, and even in the Republican primaries to some extent. So this is a good year for a third party candidate. And I agree, the Greens, it would be a good year for us to run a strong candidate. And it's not too late. And there may be some news on that by the time we meet next week. I can't reveal what I know, but it's not me, but it's somebody that can run a credible campaign. So stay tuned on that. And it could be a good year for the Greens in terms of getting a significant vote and putting issues. I mean, this is the most important thing. We got to move the debate in this country toward our positions on an equal socialist Green New Deal, Medicare for all, real public housing program to house the homeless. You know, tax reform, progressive tax reform. You know, the Democrats have not repealed the Trump tax cuts, let alone the Bush tax cuts, which is why probably the biggest reason we have such a big deficit, along with all the military spending we don't need to do that we've been doing. So, yeah, I agree. This would be a great year, and it's not over yet. We may end up with a good candidate and an opportunity to, you know, make a difference in this race. And given that Kennedy and West have got coverage, our candidate really has an argument with the mainstream media that our candidate should be covered. So let's see what happens. But, you know, it could be a good year for us, and just in terms of establishing ourselves as the progressive alternative to the Democrats. So keep your fingers crossed and hope for the best, and we'll see what happens. But there'll be some news, I think, by next week on that. Frankie Lee, I really only like Claudia De La Cruz of PSL. Can the Greens compete with her anti-capitalist message? Howie. I would hope a Green candidate for president would present an anti-capitalist message that was clear and strong on issues like the eco-socialist Green New Deal, Medicare for All as a national health service, public housing, not just incentives for affordable housing to private developers. Those kinds of socialistic policies are what we really need right now. The problem with Claudia De La Cruz and the Party for Socialism and Liberation is they confuse socialism, which means full political and economic democracy, with authoritarian states like Assad's Syria and Kim's North Korea and Xi's China. And if that's what we're telling people socialism is, it's not going to be popular with the American people. I think Bernie Sanders was popular because he broke it down into domestic policies that made sense to people on their own terms. And he said, yeah, I'm a democratic socialist. I think that's how you convince people that we need system change, not just reforms of the system. But you can't point to authoritarian regimes and say that's a model of socialism. That'll turn people off quickly. And that's what the PSL does. So I think we can more than compete with the PSL when it comes to the election. We always have. I think I got a little over 400,000 votes and nobody was paying attention to me. And I think Gloria Lariva for PSL got, you know, maybe 80,000 votes. So that was a 5-1 victory on the left. Not that 400,000 votes, I mean, it's something, but I think the potential for the Green Party this year, especially given the way Biden, I mean, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with Biden just because he seems to be old and out of step. And now he's alienated a lot of people with his Israel policy. So it's a real opportunity for the Greens. Violet at Content Boutique. I wish we could draft Sean Fain. Yeah, Sean Fain is the new, I guess he's president of the UAW. He just secured these contracts with which the workers are now voting on the contract proposals. I heard from Diane Feely, who is, you know, we had her on the podcast talking about the strike a few weeks ago. She said at the Michigan Assembly Plant in Michigan, which is one of the biggest plants, the vote in favor of the contract was 88%. So it looks like they're going through. So Sean Fain has done a lot. I don't think he's looking to run for president. He's looking to organize more auto factories, because while we have as many auto workers, or more actually than we had in the early 80s, instead of them all being in unions, only about 20% are. Because all these companies from Europe and Asia have set up plants in right-to-work states, mainly in the South, but you know, in some other places with right-to-work states, and those workers are not organized. Now, because of these contracts, one of those companies, Toyota, is saying they're going to raise the wages of their workers, trying to head off a unionization drive. So these contracts are already having a good impact. And they open up the opportunity to organize. And then as part of these contracts, at least GM, I'm not sure about all the details, or maybe it was Ford, like I said, I'm not sure the details, said that they would allow the union to organize the chains, the plants in the supply chain for electric vehicles, which are going to be growing, which is a new sector that the bosses, the owners of the auto companies were hoping would be union free, but that's one of the gains of the contract. They're going to have an opportunity to organize those plants. So, Sean Fain, a guy like him, the guy who heads the one of the postal workers unions, Diamondstein, I think is his last name. I forget his first name. He's very much for independent politics. You know, maybe he would, he's been talking about it a long time. It's somebody we should be talking to if we do have a presidential candidate, and see if we can enlist his support, or at least talk to him about his advice for how to approach the labor movement in this campaign. Violet de Content Poteet. Sean put a plan for a general strike yesterday. I did not see that. I did not hear about that, but I'm definitely going to check it out. Via email, comments on various Trump trials. Well, I hope they go forward with all deliberate speed, as the Supreme Court likes to say. I know that judge, what's her name, Eileen Collins, I think, that likes to give favors to Trump is talking about slowing down the documents case, which could slow it down till after the election. That should go forward. The you know, vote stealing or fraud case in Georgia seems to be going forward. Of course, the civil cases on various business frauds that the Trump organization committed. I mean, the judge has already kind of ruled that they're guilty. The question is, how much are they going to have to disgorge to pay back the state on taxes, for example, and you know, the banks and insurance companies they defrauded. So what's the other one? There are four big trials. Oh, and then the insurrection trial. I'm not sure what the timetable is for that, but that is underway. And that a prosecutor that Merrick Garland appointed, Jack Smith, I think his name is, he seems to be, he's not going to defer if he doesn't have to, if the judge doesn't slow him down. So I think the sooner these can come to decisions, the better. And before the election, let's hope. But I think those trials, those indictments, they're 91 felonies, that's hurting Trump, even in the Republican Party. In fact, that's, I think, why Kennedy, you know, for the various anti-vax people who are in the Republican wing of the political spectrum are saying they're going to vote for him instead of Trump. And I forget which poll it was. Maybe it was Iowa or maybe it was national. What's his name? The guy from Florida. I'm blanking on his name. That governor of Florida and the former governor of South Carolina both seem to be gaining a little bit on Trump. And as I remember the numbers, you know, combine their vote and it's getting close to Trump's. So he may be in trouble. So, and these trials are not helping him for sure. Nikki Haley is the one candidate and Ron DeSantis is the other. Yeah, thanks. Z Manny, I heard a good comment about Green Party aspiring to act as the electoral arm of social movements like UAW, Medicare for all, living wages, climate reform, prison reform. Tell Fine how Greens can help. Oh, yeah, Sean Fain can help the UAW. Yeah, that's what we have aspired to be, to give the social movements in the streets and in the communities a voice in elections. And, you know, those are the links that got to be built from the bottom up. I mean, we have a presidential candidate that can talk to the head of that postal workers union and, you know, other unions that have been open to independent politics like UE. But you got to build those relationships at the local level. And then they flow up. It just can't be announced from the top down. You've got to have buy-in at the grassroots. So that's why when we run candidates, our candidates should be going to the unions and asking for support. And even if they don't get it, they explain, you know, our positions on issues, which generally are, you know, they are pro-labor and generally things the unions would support. You know, their reluctance to support us in a lot of elections is that we're spoilers. Of course, then we bring up ranked choice voting and proportional representation. And, you know, over the years, I've got a lot of union endorsements because, you know, these guys have seen me on the issues. I was a Teamster. I was active in, you know, local labor movement. And so despite the spoiler question, I did get a lot of endorsements. Even running for governor, we got 6 local teachers unions to endorse us, despite the state federation telling them not to, because we were speaking to issues that were really important to them in that election about education funding and high stakes testing. And these teachers, you know, they were for it. Even in 2018, the Buffalo Teachers Federation, I went to them. I was the only gubernatorial candidate to go to them asking for an endorsement. And they put it through their political committee, which recommended to their executive committee that they endorse nobody, not Cuomo, not me. And they brought that to the membership, and the membership said, no, we want to support Howie. And so I got that endorsement. So those are the kind of relationships. And, you know, it's a matter of, you may not, you know, get the endorsement the first time, but, you know, if you're active on the issues and they see you around and you keep coming back, after a while, you can win people over. And the more we do that locally, then when we talk about national unions, when we have a presidential candidate, you know, it becomes a much more realistic possibility. And that's true, not just with the labor movement, but all these movements. You know, we got to be part of them. They got to know who we are. They got to see we're consistent. And then, you know, they'll look a lot more favorably on us than if we just show up at election time and say, endorse us. We got a good platform. But they're wondering where we've been in between elections. So we got to be a party of the movement, and also a party that can give the movement's expression in elections. Amy L. Sachs, I don't know how anyone can look at Trump versus Biden and think we're spoiling anything. Laugh out loud. He just made me laugh out loud. That's true. But on the other hand, there's still a lot of people that see Trump as a, you know, mortal threat to democracy. And as bad as Biden is, they're going to hold their nose and vote for him. So I think, you know, one of the key issues, and I wished I'd elevated this more when I ran in 2020, even though I didn't get a lot of opportunities to debate it or talk about it in the media, is electoral reform. We should, you know, if I added a 4th theme to the Eagle Socialist Green New Deal, Economic Bill of Rights, and peace policies, it would have been inclusive multi-party democracy. And the reforms we start with are ranked choice voting for executive offices like president, and proportional representation in legislatures like the House. That we got to really put up there, so when we're called spoilers, we can say, no, we have an answer to the spoiler problem. And will the Democrats, or if you're the president's candidate, will Joe Biden join us in pushing for ranked choice voting in the presidential election? That will solve the spoiler problem. And if Joe Biden won't join us, he is the spoiler. He's keeping the system that creates the spoiler dilemma, the plurality winner system. So I think we can turn that around on them, and it's got to be a high priority, because if we can end the spoiler problem and then particularly get proportional representation, you know, we're going to be part of legislatures from city council to the House, because we have enough support to meet a 5% or 10% threshold. And once we're in there, that gives us a lot of legitimacy. It gives us a platform to advance our policies. And I've always said getting in the debate is half the problem, because once we're in the debate, we can win the debate. Medicare for all, the majority of people are for that. Green New Deal, the majority of people are for that. Most people like what the Greens are talking about more than they like what the Democrats and Republicans propose. Our problem is that we're seen as spoilers given the dominance of the two-party duopoly. So that's why inclusive multi-party democracy is a theme, and ranked choice voting and proportional representation as particular reforms, I think, should be leading issues for us. Ashley R., why aren't Greens demanding that Trump be deemed ineligible from running for office? Well, I think some of us are. That goes back to the 14th Amendment that says if you try to overthrow the government, you can't run for federal office. And there are lawsuits in several states that are pushing that. And we'll see what happens. You know, it may be the courts say, well, first he has to be found guilty in the insurrection case that Jack Smith's working on. But we'll see. You know, just from the evidence that we all have seen, you know, Trump looks guilty as hell. So we'll see. That's going to be decided in the courts. And it won't be long because there's a deadline with primaries starting to come up after the first of the year. Emil Sachs, nod, Howie. I think the problem is that Democratic leaders love that this system keeps producing more Trumps. They want to maintain their shared monopoly with the GOP. But yeah, please keep talking about PR, et cetera. Yeah, the Democrats, they know what the solution to the spoiler problem is. They're not stupid. They know. Some of them even put a bill in for proportional representation in the House. But none of them have put in a bill for a ranked choice national popular vote for president. You know, back in, I think it was 1970, maybe 1969, Senator Bayh from Indiana led a move to get rid of the Electoral College and replace it with a national popular vote. And it had a runoff provision. If nobody got 40%, there'd be a, you know, a runoff election, which is better than what has been proposed since then, but not got much support or energy behind it. And that is a national popular vote. Dick Durbin has been behind that in many years, at least in the, around 2000, after the Bush v. Gore problem. You know, he said he would reintroduce a bill he already had. Hillary Clinton, her first news conference here in New York after she won her Senate seat in Binghamton, she said she was going to push for getting rid of the Electoral College. And, you know, I've looked this up. In that session of Congress, they didn't even put that bill in. So, you know, you just can't count on the Democrats to do anything. So, yeah, and they want to maintain their shared monopoly. That's Biden still talking about bipartisanship with the party that tried to overthrow his election, you know, or Nancy Pelosi saying we need a Republican Party like we used to have. And that's accommodating these neo-fascists that Trump is, you know, their hero. We need to defeat them, not accommodate them. And the Democrats don't know how to fight the fascists. They want to cut deals with them. And that's, you know, how we end up like with this debt ceiling deal, which froze domestic spending. And now the Republicans are going to push it at us again. November 17th, if we don't get a deal, the government's going to shut down. So the Republicans create these crises, and then the Democrats cut a deal with them on the Republicans' terms, and everything keeps moving to the right. But the Democratic leaders, who are fully corporate funded and corporate indentured, you know, they're fine with that, which is why, you know, the Green Party needs to step up. Zimani, any updates on drafting legislation to introduce to get third parties back on the New York State ballot? Also, I hear New York State now may be expanding ballot initiatives. So maybe New York State public could also vote on this in a referendum. The latter point I have not heard. And, you know, the legislature is not in session, so I don't know where that's coming from. I know there are groups that have been pushing for that for years, but I haven't heard of any recent movement on that. But maybe you know something I don't. Yeah, we've been having discussions in our working group. The work has slowed for a while, but seems the energy is picking up. So we'll be meeting again and getting a bill that we've been asked to draft to get to a state senator and an assembly person. So I expect we will have a bill that we can get introduced in the new session that begins in January. And then if we get that far, then we'll build a campaign to support that legislation. And I heard, got an email today from someone who had gone to a DSA meeting, and you know, somebody there was interested in, they had supported me when I ran in 2006 against Clinton for U.S. Senate, and was wondering why I didn't apply for endorsement in 2024. And I had to write back, look, you know, we getting on the ballot is for U.S. Senate is as hard as getting on the ballot for president or governor. 45,000 signatures in 42 days. And I'm not even going to think about something like a Senate race until I know I could get on the ballot. So that's where my energy is going at this point. Jesse, are you running for the nomination? I assume you mean president? No. I know that, I know what it takes to run a presidential campaign. You need a campaign team. And you really need to start earlier than this point, unless you've got some money yourself to jumpstart the process, which I don't have. So, no, I'm not running this time. I'm hoping to be able to support a Green candidate. And if we don't have one, supporting our candidates down ballot. There's still plenty of opportunities to run local, state, and federal races. And we should be doing a lot more of that. We have 146 elected officials around the country, and most of those are local. I guess all of them at this point. We win a high percentage of those races. We should be running a lot more and building a political base at the local level on which to, as a platform to then run credible races for the House of Representatives and the state legislatures. So, I will be supporting other candidates this cycle and trying to get fair ballot access law in New York State so we can get our statewide candidates back on the ballot. Via email, anything you're watching on Election Day nationally? Well, I'll be looking to see how the, let's see. There are a few referendums on ranked choice voting. And I'm not clear. I'm kind of waiting for Fair Vote to do the post-election analysis because they follow that closely. But I know, I think Oregon has one coming up this year or next year. I know next year Nevada does. There may be some other states. And then there are a lot of referendums on that at the local level. Most of them to add ranked choice voting, some of them to repeal it. So I'll be, that's probably what I'll be looking at nationally, how this movement for election reform that will end the spoiler problem is going. We've been gaining a lot of momentum the last few years. And I have to say locally, the only thing I'm going to vote on is a ballot, you know, referendum on whether the auditor should have subpoena power to find out what the mayor's doing. Of course, the mayor's opposed, the auditor's for it. And that's what I'm voting for. Otherwise, it's all Democrats and some marginal Republicans that are so marginal. Every time Greens run, we beat them. So it's really not a choice. And they're not doing anything. And unfortunately, the Greens have withered a bit in Syracuse between the push of Trump and the pull of Sanders into the Democratic Party. And COVID took a big hit. And I've been asked to run for governor and president and have not been able to do much local organizing. So we got to rebuild, but there, you know, this is a place where there's a real opportunity to present an alternative to the Democrats who have every office in the city. And a lot of cities like that, you know, that's what we should be doing. And hopefully we've sort of gone through the phase where everybody went run into groups like DSA with Sanders and then find out, it's kind of a dead end, and you're really diluting. If you think you're a socialist and you're going in a capitalist party, you're really confusing people and not educating people on the kind of system change we need. I see a lot of, DSA chapters are just supporting, liberal Democrats, but not system change people. And so the socialist movement kind of disappears when it does that. And I think that's a mistake. And I think more people are beginning to reckon with that. So I think the opportunities for the Greens are going to open up more than we've had the last, really since 2016, between Sanders, Trump, and COVID. See, Manny, this would be a good year to have a green wave of candidacies on different high-profile races, including presidency, show the scale of the Green Party presence, and run versus well-known adversaries to get coverage. Yeah, I think that is something that's within our capacity, and we have not done as well as we should in publicizing our candidates. We've had this green wave idea, few election cycles, but it really hasn't reached the mass media. And that's where it needs to get. So a lot more people recognize that. For example, 146 local elected officials, and more people know about Shama Sawant, the only elected official of Socialist Alternative. And she's not running for re-election, so they're going to have none. We've just not done a good job of letting people, not just in the mass media, but the progressive media, know that we're a real presence in local elections in a lot of communities. And so that's something we should toot our horn about a lot more. Here we go. Via email, comments on the FTX trial guilty verdict. Okay, FTX. Not sure what that stands for. FTX. You're going to have to tell me what FTX is. If I know about it, I'll tell you what I think. Oh, the crypto trial that ended this week. Yeah, that guy, part of his last name was Bankman. That's what I always remember. Bankman Fried. I didn't follow it closely, but the guy defrauded people. And, he paid for it. And he was, all that money he defrauded people of, he was spending on politics, which is what rich people do. But, I'm glad he got caught. Corporate crime is taking more money from us than street crime by far. And most of those guys get away with stuff. So, I'm glad to see it happen. Scout Trooper 164. We need to stop focusing so much on war, regardless of who's doing it. I wouldn't be surprised if that has a part in climate change with hot bombs made. Well, yeah, the bombs heat up the temperature a little bit, but the big problem is all the fossil fuels that go into operating these military machines. They're a big part of, they're a big industry in terms of the use of fossil fuels. And all the money we're spending on military hardware and the salaries of people staffing armed forces could be devoted to this huge transition we've got to make from a fossil fuel-based economy to one based on renewable energy. It's a massive reconstruction job. And when we did our eco-socialist Green New Deal budget, we found, as other efforts at a budget, going back to studies done in the 90s by a Harvard MIT group that one of the Boston Globe writers, whose name is skipping my mind right now, Ross Gelbspan, they found the bottleneck is labor. we don't have enough people to do the work. All the massive construction work, as well as a lot of factory work to manufacture the components that we need for renewable energy. All these people in arms could be devoted, you know, swords into plowshares. How about swords into windmills and solar panels? That's what I think the biggest detriment of war and militarism is to the effort to address climate change. So, yeah, stop focusing on war. We've got to, you know, make the moral equivalent of war fighting climate change. And, you know, that's why anti-militarism has to be part of a Green New Deal. That was one of, you know, my criticisms of the watered-down Green New Deal that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Markey put in that non-binding Green New Deal resolution. They deleted important parts of what the Green Party had been talking about for a decade, including deep cuts in military spending to help fund and staff a Green New Deal. They also dropped the ban on fracking and new fossil fuel infrastructure, the phase out of nuclear power, and some, I'm not sure Markey has this position. He didn't used to. We knew him in the Clamshell Alliance when he's a member of Congress, but AOC is open to building new nuclear power plants, as are, you know, some other people. Bhaskar Sankara, you know, the guy that started Jacobin, is now, I guess he's publisher of The Nation. He's pro-nuke. I mean, and these people, they don't know what they're talking about, because with the money we spend on new nuclear power, we could build a lot more energy capacity in solar and wind. It's dirty, it's dangerous, and we don't know what to do with the waste. I mean, there's so many arguments against it. Plus, it takes too long to build them, you know, a decade or more. In the next decade, we should be building wind and solar and a smart grid to accommodate distributed generation by wind and solar panels. So they're just missing the boat. And so that non-binding Green New Deal is deficient. And the other way it's deficient is it extended the deadline we were talking about throughout the 2010s of doing it by 2030. They extended it to 2050, which is too late to get to zero emissions. And then they changed zero emissions, real zero emissions, to net zero, which leaves the door open to the fossil fuel industry to keep burning fossil fuels, saying they will capture the carbon and, you know, pump it underground. And what they're doing is actually pumping it into oil wells so they can get more oil out of those wells. That's what this whole fight going on right now against carbon dioxide piping that will go from the Midwest up to North Dakota, the Bakken oil field, so they can pump more oil out of those wells they've already drilled. That's what they're doing with the CO2, which doesn't reduce the CO2. It's pumping out more oil to burn and put more CO2 in the atmosphere. I mean, this is all, you know, kind of crazy. So, but you know, the point I was making is the Democrats' Green New Deal doesn't even address the problem of war and militarism, to taking away resources that need to be devoted to reconstructing our economy around clean energy. And then, of course, that non-binding Green New Deal, which they introduced again this session, has never been voted on. You know, the leadership of the Democratic Party doesn't want to address it. So it just, you know, sits in committee, and it's something that people like AOC can point to. They introduced it, but it's not going anywhere, given who the Democrats are. They're indentured to, you know, big oil just as much as the Republicans, even though big oil gives a lot more to the Republicans. It was crypto trial, right? There was a big win against CO2 pipelines with the cancellation of the Heartland Greenway CO2 pipeline recently. Yeah, I think I saw that. I did see that. And that's why I was saying we're fighting them. But that's the headline I saw. And yeah, that's a big win. And we got to keep, you know, these plans are going to keep popping up because the industry has a lot of money. They can get the investment for these things. They got the money for PR. And but the grassroots efforts, you know, don't underestimate us. You know, we do make a difference. And here's a case where we did. Zimani, also good timing since Sanders and squad are fully exposed as Dem flunkies. No more confusion here. Plus unpopularity of Biden and Trump. Plus global issues clarifying duopoly. Good for third party. Yep, I think you're right. I guess I give a little more slack to Sanders and the squad. They're like the somewhat dissenting side of the Democrats, and they do put out things like the ceasefire that need to be raised. And I'm glad there are at least a few of them in Congress we can get to do that. Although, you know, they've endorsed Biden. They endorsed him a long time ago. They didn't make any demands on him, which is a problem with the progressives in the Democratic Party. You know, they don't fight. They you know, try to get along with the corporate leadership, which as far as the corporate leadership is concerned, the only thing these progressives are good for is to make the Democratic Party look better than it is. Other than that, they don't want to give them anything. But I think your basic point is right. This is a opening for the Green Party in this political climate, and I hope we can take advantage of it. Zimani, any thoughts on Bill Stodden, the new socialist candidate, also comparing with PSL? Any news regarding peace and freedom? This would have been a good year for fusion campaign like yours or mine in 2020. Yeah, I agree. It would be good if the Greens and socialists were running the same ticket. The Greens didn't get their act together in time. The socialists always nominate in October before the election year, in theory, so they can go out and then really get on the ballot. I don't know Bill Stodden. I do know the Socialist Party platform. I'm sure he's got good issues. The question I have is whether the Socialist Party is really going to put him on many ballots. You know, last time they put much effort into it, which probably goes back to the 90s, it was only seven states, something like that. And when I ran, you know, they were happy, I think, to have me and Angela Walker, both of whom were also Socialist Party members, to nominate. But they didn't have any capacity to help with ballot access. They really, you know, it was more a paper endorsement. So we'll see what they can actually do. I think their politics are much better than PSL in terms of democratic socialism. Peace and freedom is really controlled by PSL now. They get their members to get on the county committees and the state committee of peace and freedom. So they control the nomination. Peace and freedom will have a primary, but the decision is made by a state committee convention in August of the election cycle. And I don't see any reason why they won't put the PSL back on the ballot. That's going to be PSL's, you know, biggest state that they get on. And yeah, it would have been a good year for a Green Socialist Fusion campaign, but I think that horse has left the barn. Although I'm just wondering, it just occurred to me, if the candidate I'm thinking of doesn't actually run, maybe the Greens should approach Stodden and his running mate, whose name escapes me at the moment, about, you know, being the Green candidate. I don't know what they think about that, but there's always possibilities. Andrew Hager, is there such a thing as eco-friendly land development, as in building a neighborhood entirely of eco-friendly technologies and whatnot? And what sacrifices would we have to be made to make it happen? Yeah, I mean, I think definitely. If you look at, you know, pre-capitalist development, like indigenous people in the Americas, they developed land. They weren't just, you know, hunting and gathering. They were actually, you know, being active in developing the land. They would set fires, for example, to keep meadowlands open that game they hunted are used. And then they, you know, in other areas, created, you know, gardens and farms that were very integrated with the regional ecology. And, you know, that's going back a long time, but, you know, it's not like nature and the Indians were just like part of it. They actually shaped their environment. And then we've had, you know, going back in my experience to, you know, Paul Goodman and Percival Goodman, the book Communitas, and Murray Bookchin with his, what do you call it, technology, he didn't call it appropriate technology, he called it eco-technology. You can develop living space and production systems that are integrated into their regional ecology. Lewis Mumford wrote about that as well, starting in the 20s and 30s. So, you know, and I wouldn't consider it a sacrifice to make it happen. I think that would make better communities and ways of living. And, you know, people would actually see where their food and their products are coming from and how, you know, they are part of nature, or integrated with it, not, you know, separate from it. So that, you know, people now living in urban areas think food comes from grocery stores. That's about all they know about it. So, yeah, that's, I think, what we got to be striving for. Eco-friendly land development, also redevelopment of the land we already occupy. There was great stuff. I remember around the first Earth Day, there was a group of architects in Berkeley. I think they called themselves Berkeley Radical Architecture. They talked about how they could take the street grid and another guy who was one of the early Greens, Paul Glover, wrote a pamphlet for doing that in Los Angeles, where they would bring back the trolley system, which was great in Los Angeles. It was incredible before they tore it up at the behest of the auto industry. And then that pamphlet on Los Angeles, I'm trying to remember what it was called, that Paul Glover did, you know, the cover, it's black and white in the first square, and it's like a cartoon panel. And by the time you get to the last square, it's all green because, you know, they reforested the city. They brought urban agriculture in. They replaced streets with green space and trolleys. And the Berkeley Radical Architects did the same thing. There's a book. There are a couple of books from that period. I think the Environmental Handbook might have had it. It came back then. You'd have to dig it up in your library. I can't remember the exact title right now, but these ideas have been around a long time in the radical ecology movement. And it's something that, you know, should be part of our municipal programs as we run for office. Woody Collins, how can we get the big authoritarian countries such as China to switch to a more sustainable future with them being the biggest CO2 emitter? Well, I think we got to offer them deals they can't refuse because they're so good. And that means the United States leading the way as the richest country in the world with, you know, good technology base, says, you know, we're going to work with China and to help them transition more quickly to a renewable future. And together, as the two biggest economies in the world, we should help the whole world do that and make it, you know, a business proposition. And instead of what we're doing now is trying to compete economically with China in kind of a zero-sum game. You know, if we gain, they lose. If they gain, we lose. Rather than seeing it as a win-win proposition where we both gain. And I think that's how we need to approach China. And then Russia, you know, is the big one because they are so dependent on oil and gas and coal exports. And they don't have much else. And so, you know, that's what we should be offering, you know, as an olive branch to Russia. You know, we will help you diversify in going a renewable way. And that's going to be tough because Putin, you know, he doesn't even believe in climate change. You know, he's sometimes sort of nodded. Yeah, in the chat, it says Paul Glover's Los Angeles, A History of the Future. And it's online. Really, that's a good book to look at, or pamphlet. It's one of my favorite pamphlets. But, you know, in the case of Russia, you know, we should be in solidarity with the Russian environmental movement, a lot of which is in exile. They face enormous repression. And, but, you know, at the state level, you know, top level, U.S. state to Russian state, we should be, you know, offering them ways to help them make the transition, because we're getting off of oil and gas. The rest of the world is. Russia needs to adapt. And we should offer, you know, ways to help them do that. And that's tough because, on the other hand, you don't want to ignore their human rights violations and their, you know, in Russia's case in particular, you know, their military imperialism, you know, Ukraine, Syria, several African countries, Libya. They're very busy backing up authoritarian leaders in return for oil, timber, gold, diamond, other mineral concessions. And it's, you know, classic imperialism. And, you know, for them, it's a big source of revenue because they don't have much else going for them besides their oil and gas. So that is a, I think, a tougher nut to crack than China, which on paper is committed to building an ecological civilization. So we should, you know, take that as an opening and look for ways to work together. And, you know, part of that is, and it's a concern of, you know, our national security, diversifying our supply chain so we're not so dependent on China, where, you know, U.S. capitalists went running to for the cheap labor, and now we're dependent on them for a lot of products. Part of building a sustainable future is that there's a lot more production locally and less shipping of parts and everything, you know, across oceans, which is, you know, energy intensive and makes countries dependent on each other in ways they don't want. So we should be, you know, working together to diversify all our countries in a way that's sustainable. And, you know, if you're sustainable to a large degree on your own resources, you have less incentive to be imperialistic, grabbing resources from other areas. So there's a lot to be said, even as we, you know, criticize the human rights problems, which I don't think we can drop because, you know, it's a bottom line. If we're talking about an eco-socialist future, we're talking about a radically democratic future. And, you know, nobody should be let off the hook on that. Okay, well, our hour's up. I appreciate the questions and the thoughts. And I just want to go back to, you know, I think the immediate thing we really got to push is for the ceasefire. And then from there, replacing the war with the peace process. And that requires fundamental change in U.S. policy. And I don't know if we could ever get that out of the Democrats, but certainly we can push for that. And, you know, the street actions are part of that. So is the elections. So we have, you know, I think a clear objective there. And as I pointed out last week, you know, meanwhile, Turkey's bombing the hell out of Rojava and trying to destroy the autonomous administration of North and East Syria, which they see as a threat. You know, it's not just their, you know, ethno-nationalism against the Kurds, like it was against the Armenians, but it's the democratic threat that that poses to authoritarian governments like Turkey, as well as the whole Middle East. That's a conflict that's sort of out of sight, out of mind, but we've got to, I think, do what we can to support the experiment in, you know, radical democratic, ecological, feminist, anti-sectarian democracy in Rojava. It could be a model for the Middle East. And there are other conflicts going on. You know, the U.S. is so hypocritical. They cut a deal with Morocco as part of this, accord with Israel. And they support Morocco's claim on Western Sahara. And the people there, the Polisario Front, they want independence. They've wanted it for years, and we don't support it. They're the people in West Papua. I mean, the Indonesian, occupation of that after they voted for independence decades ago is still violent and really genocidal. And it's another settler colonial situation where they're bringing in Indonesians to take the land and set up mines and cut the forests of West Papua. And then we just had the expelling of the Armenians in Artuk or Kabarak, I get those names straight, but that was within Azerbaijan. That was ethnic cleansing of over 100,000 people. I mean, this is going on all over. It's not just, what's happening to the Palestinians, although they're the headlines and probably the most violent conflict going on right now. Not to mention Ukraine. I mean, if you follow that news, there was a terrible story this week about a family of nine Ukrainians living, somewhere outside of Mariupol in the Donetsk region that were murdered by a Russian soldier who wanted to take their home from them. So they're having a birthday party, just came in and killed them, little kids as well as the parents. And that kind of violence and, displacement is the same kind of thing we're seeing like in the West Bank of Israel. So there are a lot of things we got to address. But I think right now there's momentum and we're making progress on the ceasefire now demand with respect to the war in Gaza. So I hope people will do everything they can to push that issue. I see Zimani asking, is West Papua turning into another Timor, East Timor? Yeah, it already is. It's been going on. I actually am in touch with Greens in Papua New Guinea. On the other side of that same island is West Papua. And they are trying to build a Green Party in East Papua and also in East Timor. So they are very much fighting the colonialism that's been going on. In any case, I've pointed to a lot of problems and why we need an anti-imperialist, consistently anti-imperialist Green Party to take on, the biggest empire in the world, that is of the United States. So I hope everybody has a good week, stays active, and we'll see you next week.